From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting from the Ring of Fire Studios in Pensacola, Florida. On today's show, attention, Walmart shoppers. Oh, I know that's supposed to be Kmart, but I just couldn't resist. You don't get many chances to do that. Because later in the show, we're going to hear from a professor who's just written a book about Walmart and religion. She's some interesting things to say about free markets and Christian evangelicalism. More on that to come. Plus an update on the top secret religious organization known as the Fellowship. But first, we turn our focus south to my own home state, Louisiana, where a story involving our Governor Bobby Jindal recently caught my eye. It was revealed early this week that Governor Jindal has been using a state helicopter to fly to church services throughout Louisiana, a practice which, according to the Baton Rouge paper, The Advocate, has cost the state of Louisiana $45,000 taxpayer dollars since March of this year. Now, when I read that story, I wrote to the governor, and I asked him, among other things, to apologize to citizens of the state of Louisiana and to reimburse the state of Louisiana the $45,000 he used to visit churches. I'm joined right now by Mark Ballard, the editor-in-charge of the Advocate's Capital News Bureau. Mark, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
The big question for me is, how is this not a violation of the separation of church and state? As I read the story, Jindal, Governor Jindal, is using taxpayer dollars to fund his visits to churches. How do you justify that?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, it seems to, at least, you know, at first blush, violate the separation of church and state to me as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I could be proven wrong. The best I can do is to take Governor Jindal at his word, and he mm-hmm. says that he gets something out of going out and sharing by worshiping with folks in parts of the state that haven't seen a governor in years.
Right. And, you know, I think it's a very legitimate comment, especially in Northeast Louisiana, where governors don't come very frequently. Mark, my contention is that if the governor was going to worship, he ought to pay like everybody else does, their own way to worship. But if he's going as a representative of the state of Louisiana, then he ought not be using state funds to put in an appearance in a house of worship. And if he does, if he's just looking for dealing with a broader base of his constituency, which is fine, I wouldn't think that would be in a house of worship that draws only a particular group of people. Those are my arguments. And but Governor Jindal, as you know, is a devout Catholic, but these are all Protestant churches throughout the state of Louisiana. What kind of explanation is given for his visits from that perspective? Do you know?
We asked specifically about that, and he basically said that he was trying to share with people in other parts of the state. There are some political analysts that we've talked to who are looking at it and saying, well, that may be what he is saying, but if you look at in 2003 when he ran against the Governor Kathleen Blanco and she won, he only carried a handful of parishes in North mm-hmm. Louisiana. And from 2003 to 2007, he focused on going to churches, the small churches in North Louisiana, doing this this kind of witnessing thing, and as he has continued to do after becoming governor. And then in the 2007 election, he pretty much swept North Louisiana, and as you'll recall, that he mm-hmm. won in the primary election. He won outright in the primary election, which is very rare for a non-incumbent to do in the state of Louisiana.
Mark, can you give us a generalization about what the governor usually talks about on these church visits?
Generally, and we know this from he does say they're very secretive about where they're going and rarely let us know about it, particularly in advance. Mm-hmm. So, but a lot of folks take YouTube is a wonderful thing, and a lot of folks take videos of his speeches. So we have a handful of videos of what he says, and from in those videos that we watched, he follows a pretty much a standard kind of playbook. Well, playbook is probably an unfair characterization, but he basically he talks about the military and how we should support our soldiers. He talks about his personal coming to Christianity. His family is Hindu originally, mm-hmm. and he talks about his personal coming to Christianity, to mm-hmm. Catholicism, and talks about what he calls his relationship with God. And that generally, he says the same thing, at least in most of the YouTube videos that we've watched.
I see. I'm curious. I'm in this fray with you, and I know what I'm hearing. What kind of response have you gotten from the governor's office after your article?
Well, the governor's office, you sent out your letter yesterday or the day before, and
yes.
We reported about it. And
right.
The governor did not address it directly, but his staff was very critical of you and the organization.
yes, that's true.
And some of the bloggers that support Governor Jindal has been, basically writing, this is all a liberal political front attacking, good Christian politicians.
Yeah.
Or speaking of the Interfaith Alliance.
Yes. Yes.
And Michelle, the reporter who wrote the story, she's been pretty soundly thrashed and had her own beliefs and questioned repeatedly and been called names over this. We were not trying to make any judgments, just kind of to point out that this was what was going on.
I mean,
and because it is a use of taxpayer dollars. It's a use of my tax dollars, your tax dollars.
Yes.
And just, what is going on with it?
Well, it raises larger questions, and you were doing what a good newspaper ought to do in giving people facts and then letting people make judgments about them and pursue more truth about them, and I appreciate that. My guest is Mark Ballard. He's political editor with The Advocate, the Baton Rouge paper, which broke the story about Governor Bobby Jindal's use of a state helicopter to attend church services throughout Louisiana. Mark, thanks very much for being with us on State of Belief.
I appreciate you asking us to come.
All right. Do you want to read my letter to Governor Jindal? I wish you would. I'd kind of like to know what you think about it. Go to interfaithalliance.org. It's all there. I'm Welton Gaddy. And in more news at the intersection of religion and politics, a group of conservatives seems to be wondering what all the fuss over healthcare reform is all about. Spokespeople for a recently formed organization known as the Freedom Federation say that, yes, our healthcare system has some problems, but mostly it works. really. That assessment of our current healthcare system comes courtesy of Bishop Harry Jackson from Hope Christian Church in suburban Maryland, who apparently sees our current system as successful. Religious conservatives like Tony Perkins over at the Family Research Council, who of course is also a member of the Freedom Federation, have been going around the country saying that new health care legislation will introduce taxpayer-funded abortions and rationed care for the elderly, neither of which is true. But to conclude that the current system is mostly working is just to demonstrate the parochial ideology with which these people look at the world. It would not be so ludicrous did they not cloak their support of lavishly profiteering corporate health insurance companies in the language of religion. But we see through your disguise, and frankly, what we see is nothing but ugly. And now we learn that in a short period of time, President Obama is going to address Congress and perhaps take some steps back on insisting for full health care reform. I want you to know I'm glad that I will not have on my conscience silence in the face of this ugly movement. And I don't know how anyone informed by family values, caring about an ethic of life, can be satisfied with a political victory that spells defeat for 40-something thousand people now without health care that without reform will grow to 60,000 and more tragedies right away. I'm Welton Gaddy. We're coming right back, so don't go anywhere. Again, everybody, and thanks for sticking around. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. And in the current issue of Christianity Today, Congressman Frank Wolf from Virginia and former Congressman Tony Hall address the controversy surrounding a group known as the Fellowship, or more informally as the Family. This secretive religious organization recently gained national attention when the Fellowship's headquarters, a townhouse on Capitol Hill, was linked to two high-profile sex scandals. Senator John Ensign carried on an extramarital affair while a resident of the townhouse, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, was a frequent visitor to prayer sessions held by the Fellowship at their C Street location. But Wolf and Hall, the authors of this article, hope to dispel reports that the Fellowship organization is little more than a means for power-hungry fundamentalists to gain access to members of Congress and advance a religiously conservative agenda in government. Frank Wolf and Tony Hall write, these are their words, "The Fellowship does not advocate any sort of theocratic takeover of the government, and to make such an allegation misunderstands and misrepresents Christian ministry. The Fellowship," says the authors, "encourages individuals to grow in their love for God and others, to seek reconciliation and accountability in their own lives, and to do good for others and our society." Well, journalist Jeff Charlotte has an almost completely different picture to paint. Jeff spent years researching this organization for his best-selling book, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. And here is how Jeff Charlotte describes the Fellowship, or as he calls it, The Family.
The Family is a 70-year-old international network of elite Christian conservatives and government, military, and business bound together by the devotion to what the founder, a man named Abraham Verrady, called the idea. And the idea was simple and I think horrifying. Abraham Verratti believed that God had given him a new vision, that Christianity had wrongly focused on the weak, the poor, the suffering, the down and out for 2,000 years, that those whom God cared about most were those whom Abraham Verratti called the up and out, the powerful. It's a religion of more power for the already powerful, and the idea that those people will then help the weak. So it becomes sort of a trickle-down fundamentalism.
Before the Ensign and Sanford controversies, few journalists outside of Jeff Charlotte had covered the fellowship and its approach to this religion for the powerful. But recently, my fellow Air America radio host, Mike Papantonio, also has begun paying attention to the story. I asked Mike for his opinion on the mix of politics and religion that seems to be at the heart of this story. Listen to what he said.
What happened, you know, people, you kind of have to understand the backstory here. These were inheritance babies in 1933, little whiny inheritance babies that never really earned any money. They inherited it from mommy and daddy. They all got together and they said, we want to end the influence of FDR. FDR is a communist, a socialist. He's scaring us. He's going to destroy capitalism. But more importantly, he's taking away our money, you know, the money that mommy and daddy gave us. So they organized this thing called the family. And the family has been around, and the brilliance of the family is they've maintained silence. They've been off the radar screen since 1933. Media didn't pay attention to anything. Look, you had an organization that said that we build our organization against the fundamental belief that authoritarian rule, strict authoritarian rule, where you basically have a dictatorship, is the only way to run the world. And this isn't me making this up. Jeff Charlotte had enough courage to go and find the documents. The documents say this. The documents say this is what we stand for. Now, what happened out of that? You had an organization that took that philosophy and used it all over the world. They propped up Papa Doc Duvalier. You know, the bloodbath that he was taking place in Haiti. They made that happen. So if you look at their history, they have always lived their talk. They've walked their talk, and that is they want authoritarian rule. And it's not this. Look, this isn't tinfoil hat fantasy. This is all in the documents, for God's sakes. I mean, I got to pick them up and read them.
So, what is the significance of this for someone sitting listening to this program in Wichita, Kansas?
Well, the significance is they believe, the guy in Wichita, Kansas, believes that government works at an arm's length, that the democratic process works, that if we put the person in the office that we want, that we're going to get what we want. So what it tells them is it should tell them, that there's reason to be cynical about the sanctity of the democratic process. Money talks, it runs politics.
If you want to learn more about the fellowship, then I encourage you to take a look at Jeff Charlotte's book, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief, and there's more to come, including a book on Walmart and religion. That's up next. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Back, friends. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief. Ralph Reed, former head of the Christian Coalition, once said, if you want to reach the Christian population on Sunday, you do it from the church pulpit. If you want to reach them on Saturday, you do it in Walmart. Reed could have been talking about geography. Walmarts are more prevalent in parts of the country traditionally associated with religious conservatives, places like the Sun Belt and the Ozarks. But a new book argues that there is more to this equation than mere location. Bethany Morton is an assistant professor of history and women's studies at the University of Georgia. And in her book, To Serve God in Walmart, Morton provides a fascinating window into the role religion has played in the history of the world's largest company. As Morton tells it, Walmart's approach to business has been based on two ideologies: free markets and Christian evangelicalism, a combination of which has produced the secret to Walmart's success in an area of the country that would have been most resistant to the rise of the chain store. Bethany Morton joins me now by phone to tell us more about this. Bethany, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you so much for having me.
How explicit is this relationship between religion and Walmart? Did Walmart set out to be an evangelical Christian company?
Definitely not, and it's actually very important to bear in mind that this was not a company start. There are companies out there that have been started, like Chick-fil-A, for example, companies that are very explicitly ministries in a sense. And Walmart is not in that category. This was a hard-nosed businessman from the Midwest who sort of cast down his bucket where he stood, and what he dipped up there in the Ozarks turned out to be a culture that brought with it a religious revival that has really turned Walmart into the Saturday megachurch, in Ralph Reed's words, as you quoted there. So when you look at the Walmart founding family, you're not talking really about people who are anything we would recognize as the new Christian right.
In fact, am I not right, Bethany, that Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, was not a religious conservative? He's actually a part of a fairly liberal Christian church, even married to a woman who was a pro-choice advocate. So what was his interest in embracing this? I mean, was it a business decision?
It's not even really, I think, a conscious act on the part of the Walton family up there, so much as you build an organization this big in this part of the country during these decades of the 60s and 70s and 80s, and inevitably you are going to bring along with you, if you do your talent search there locally, the revival that's happening in the Sun Belt at that time. So part of what I found so interesting in this case was how much the sense of Walmart as a Christian institution was imposed from the bottom up and not really from the top down. And you ultimately then do have men in the top decision-making positions, many of them, who have sort of risen from the ranks and who also then bring up into the executive function many of these priorities. But the company publicly has walked a very fine line. On the one hand, they're well aware that their constituency is largely conservative Christians. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they are an international, multinational corporation, and they've tried not to overtly assert that identity. It's just, it's not even really necessary to do so. Mm-hmm. If you even look at the historic class action sex discrimination lawsuit against Walmart that's ongoing, Dukes v. Walmart stores. You know, these are women who are suing Walmart for sex-based discrimination. They are people who've experienced things that have driven them to that point, and yet they themselves talk about Walmart in many cases as a Christian company, that part of their impulse to apply for a job there originally was that they understood it to be a Christian company with values that they could get behind, in their words. And so the question kind of becomes, how did that identification happen?
Well, Bethany, you've looked at it very carefully, and I'm curious, as Walton watched these evangelical values, as you say, kind of rise from the bottom up. It transformed his business. How was that evident, if at all, in the structure of the company and how it was administrated?
Well, the most obvious case really is this kind of managerial philosophy of servant leadership, which is a phrase now that I think is pretty widely recognized. And it was fascinating to watch this idea, and the concept here is that not that we're going to have a business organization on the model of, say, a military organization, which used to be what they aspired to, right, where command mm-hmm. and structure and order and efficiency, but that rather the organization's going to run on service. Well, now this is a very logical development, right? We now are majority a service economy. Most of us work in service jobs. Most of us are evaluated at our jobs on the basis of how well we deal with other people, how well we serve. So to watch this philosophy move back and forth across the line from the evangelical revival, on the one hand, which animated servant leadership as the model for how people should run their homes, and at the same time, the people who were embracing that on the home front would get up and go to work and incorporate this idea into what are now increasingly their service workplaces. And for Walmart, which was the first service corporation to be the largest company on earth, you know, prior to that had been things like General Motors or Ford or Exxon, and suddenly here's Walmart, whose only product really is service. Distribution is just serving customers. And suddenly that's the largest corporation on the planet. They needed a new model, and it was evangelical culture that offered it, and it's been extraordinarily successful for them, you know, up to the point where now we are going through checkout lines that aren't even staffed. So it's
Bethany, let's hold it right there for just a second. We're This is so interesting. We're talking about a mega store growing up alongside the mega church. I'm Welton Gaddy. I'm speaking with Bethany Morton, history professor and author of the new book, To Serve God and Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise. There's more of our conversation to come. Don't go away. You're going to be fascinated by what else you hear. We'll be right back.
State of Belief, once a week, not enough? Check out our website, stateofbelief.com. Interfaith Alliance, defending democratic values and promoting religious liberty. Learn more at interfaithalliance.org.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy, and my guest today is Bethany Morton. Her new book is called To Serve God and Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise. Now, Bethany, I'm curious, did you go into this book project knowing that religion was going to play such a large role in the story?
You know, it's so funny you ask that because I ran into a fellow that I had met at a conference years before when I was first starting this. I ran into him again not long ago, and he said, you know, I was so interested to see this religious theme come up in your work because when we talked about it last, there was no suggestion of that at all. So apparently, I didn't go into it expecting to see this. It's just kind of hard to spend as much time as I spent in the Ozarks and down in Central America with the other part of the story and not recognize that, you know, that religion is the way most people make sense of the world in those settings. And you must take it respectfully, take it seriously, if you're going to understand any other kind of development, including this economic colossus that comes out of this area.
But isn't it ironic how a company that espoused family values in the form of service to others came ultimately to represent unbridled capitalism? So where do beliefs of evangelicalism and this belief in the free market intersect?
And that's the question that, you know, that we come back to. How do you, when we talk about, well, there are these economic issues, and then there are these cultural distractions that, on the one hand, you have Milton Friedman-style free market economics that becomes our national orthodoxy after the 1970s, and on the other hand, you have these, what are portrayed as these somewhat silly distractions like anti-homosexuality and anti-abortion politics. And the normal story of the culture wars is that somehow these unbridled capitalists figured out to manipulate people who care about abortion and homosexuality as their top issues that the financiers and the capitalists manipulated them into voting for administrations that would then turn around and enact this economic vision. And that struck me, again, as somewhat condescending. And so you have to ask, what might these two issues represent more broadly for people that would make this a more reasonable bargain between Jerry Falwell and Milton Friedman, right? Mm-hmm. Who are odd bedfellows, if you think about it. These are not men you would really...
Yeah, they wouldn't want you to use that term.
Precisely. So why would, here's Jerry Falwell running around denouncing a cartoon character for being insufficiently manly, and here's Milton Friedman pushing monetarist policy in Chile and finally the United States. What on earth do these have to do with each other? And again, you go back to the experience of work. People's work experience in the United States after the middle of the century was primarily service-based. And the work of service is the work of reproduction, in, again, using old-fashioned economic terms, reproductive labor versus productive labor. Productive labor is, mining the iron ore and building the railroad and so forth. Reproductive labor is taking care of people and serving people. And that became more what we do with 8, 10, 12 hours of the day that we spend on the job, after particularly starting in the 1970s. So how did that affect what people considered was important? Well, one thing I think it did was raise these issues that are dismissed as these silly cultural issues, issues like opposition to abortion, raised those to paramount importance, because those are the two issues on the table that have directly to do with reproduction.
And let's extend this irony just a little bit further, because the irony is that Walmart today, though beginning with an affirmation of family values, to many people represents greed and consumerism, the very opposite of family values. There's a lot of discussion now, as you know, that the current economic crisis that we're experiencing is a derivative of that kind of greed. So what does this mean for the future of Christian free enterprise?
I didn't meet anyone in the many years of doing this research who felt that Walmart or, Sam Walton himself, who comes to be this kind of mythic representative of Walmart, that either of those could be described as motivated by greed. Mm-hmm. I didn't meet anyone who would have told you that. What they mm-hmm. would have said was that this company is enjoying success because it has fulfilled a meaningful role for many people. It allows you to shop for your family. Think about the Walmart commercials you've seen. These are people pushing these huge carts down these aisles, getting everything they need to care for their families. And that's actually literally who shops there. That's the majority of the shoppers, right? They're not making this up. You have to remember that when Walmart came on the scene, rural consumers were deeply underserved, if you want to think about mm-hmm. consumption that way, by the distribution mechanisms in place. And the work of provisioning a family is serious labor. And to take that labor seriously and to, frankly, incorporate the women who do that labor, largely in the United States, it's women who shop for their families and spend hours a week doing this, to take that seriously was for a lot of people to perform a real service. And you have to remember, too, that there is a strain in American evangelical tradition of celebrating abundance and of taking joy in that kind of concrete expression of success. And this is not luxuries. These are not people buying most of the history of Walmart, these are not people buying luxury items. You don't mm-hmm. have to worry about the sort of sin of sensuality when what mm-hmm. you're buying is, a 24-pack of Capri Sun to put in your kid's lunchbox. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. not yeah. luxury consumption. That is necessities. Yeah. That is service in the view of many people who worked there.
Bethany, I we've got to wrap this up. I could go on and on with this, but I have to ask one question, and also ask that you be succinct with your answer.
That's a tough one.
What are the larger implications for society of what we're talking about, this mixing of religion economics? What does Christian free enterprise mean for people outside of Walmart and the evangelical circle?
Well, I'm going to borrow a little from some of the Christian commentators who have read the book and written about it and that I've been so grateful have felt that I've done a respectful job of addressing this worldview and say, ultimately, I think it's very dangerous to imagine that there is a God-ordained view of economics that has, in fact, been so destructive to so many people. But you have to remember, and this is where I think it really tells us something about the future, especially in this crisis moment that we're in right now, that it took an enormous amount of work to connect evangelical priorities, religious priorities, to this very narrow view of the world, that the market is the only final arbiter, that consumption is such an ultimate good. It takes a lot of work to maintain that connection, and I think an awful lot of religious people are in a position right now where they're rethinking that and returning to questioning why, for example, homosexuality and abortion have become so central to American religious experience, when in fact the New Testament has absolutely nothing to say about them, but it's full of statements about helping the poor, caring for your community, dealing fairly with people, showing compassion, and taking other people's material needs seriously. And I think right now, perhaps one of the healing strains that will come out of this crisis we're in is a broadening of religious viewpoints on what makes for a fair economic system.
We have to leave it there, and that's a great place to leave it. My guest today is Bethany Morton. Bethany's new book is called To Serve God and Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise. She teaches history and women's studies at the University of Georgia. It's a great project. I think you'd enjoy reading it. Bethany, do you shop at Walmart?
I have never boycotted. Personal boycotts are really meaningless, and it seems really kind of snobbish to refuse to do it. So when it's the most convenient and the only option, I do shop at Walmart, and I will until there's an organized way for us collectively to push a different alternative.
Well, thanks for being a part of State of Belief.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, friends, that's our show for this week. Do you want to get in touch? Well, then write to us. We'd love to have you write. Go to stateofbelief.com and click on the Contact Us page, or you can call us now. Remember, 202-238-3291. Call us at 202-238-3291. Tell us what you're thinking about the show, about anything else that's on your mind. State of Belief is brought to you each week by Interfaith Alliance. You want to get involved in the cause for religious liberty? Here is a way to do it. Join us. Become a member of Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. A special thanks to the good people at Ring of Fire Studios for their assistance this week. I'll be back behind the microphone, but somewhere else next week with more stories from the intersection of religion and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief. Religion and radio done differently.